UK Wine Show, show number 180 for the 30th of October 2009. George Fistinich on the business of Villa Maria. Hi guys, welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show we have another great show. We're talking with George Fistinich, the owner and manager of Villa Maria, New Zealand's largest family-owned winery and number two in terms of size in New Zealand. George tells us how he grew Villa Maria from a couple of hectares in Auckland and how the awards have saved his business in the last world recession. In the book review, we review the book The Concise World Atlas of Wine by Hugh Johnson and Jancis Robinson. And along with the news and a spotlight, it's another corker show. Speaking of corks, I've been using an Inuit gas preserver for my wines for the last wee while. I have in the past used VacuVin, where they suck the air out that preserves wine. These are okay, but some people get concerned they suck the flavour out of the wine. But I've been using this inert gas and I like it. I often come home from wine tastings with 6 to 8 bottles of wine with maybe only a glass at the bottom of each. And using the gas, I can enjoy the wines over the next 2 to 4 days, whereas they'd be pretty ruined if I'd used a VacuVin to suck the air out. I haven't seen them on the high street, but if you know anybody who sells them, can you give me a yell? I buy mine from a wholesaler and I have to spend quite a bit on each spend, so I'd like to be able to recommend them to people. So if you know who sells them or you sell them yourself, can you tweet me at Winescriber or drop me an email at chris.scott@3050.co.uk. That's chris.scott@3050.co.uk. Alright, so let's crack on with the show. This week we're going to be starting with our mystery region. Now, our mystery region has up to 13 grape varieties authorised by the Appellation for making into a powerful, richly red-coloured wine. Not all are red grapes, though, but potentially the blend can include Grenache, Mourvèdre, Syrah, Sensault, and Roussanne. Grenache is probably the most important grape variety. It appreciates the sun and gives a nice, rounded, good-coloured wine rich in alcohol and aromas of red fruits, lavender, and thyme. I'm going to give you some more clues, but they're coming up after the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Leading wine critic Tim Atkin, MW, is boycotting heavyweight wine bottles from his recommendations in his Sunday newspaper column and encouraging readers instead to buy wine in lightweight glass or even bag-in-box, plastic or Tetra Paks in order to reduce the carbon footprint of their wine drinking. He said he's prepared to name and shame producers and claim the problem of overweight bottles was most likely to be found in wines from Spain, Italy and Argentina. Tim also suggested that consumers buy wines that are shipped to the UK in bulk and bottled here, a key initiative of RAP's Glassrite project, and he cited Waitrose for its bulk importing model for its Chilean Virtue wines. Champagne and other sparkling wines won't be boycotted because heavier bottles are needed to withstand the pressure of the bubbles inside.
Good on you, Tim. While this is a problem specific to the UK, I think it's a big issue for suppliers. Some may say that heavy bottles are made from recycled glass, so it's okay. And often it is true that they're made from recycled glass, but they enter the waste stream in the UK, and the more bulk means more waste, because our lack of demand means they can't be recycled again, or closed-loop recycling as they call it. Extra weight also requires extra electricity to recycle, so even in their country of origin, they're more polluting than thinner glass. Heavyweight bottles should go and are never going to be environmentally friendly. Funnily enough, we take a Chilean wine that's very, very nice, but they claim to be organic, and it's the heaviest bottle I've ever seen. So organics is not necessarily environmentally friendly based on this. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, a new national park is to be created around the South Downs next spring, which could jeopardise expansion of a thriving wine industry, says Mike Roberts of Ridgeview. The chalky south-facing slopes and a cool climate make the area well-suited to growing grapes and producing world-class sparkling wine to rival Champagne. But Mike will see his wine estate engulfed by the park and fears there will be resistance to new building work, which would limit any future plans for extending his winery. Fortunately, he already has planning permission to increase the size of the winery, with work expected to start in the new year. Mike says there's capacity for around 1 million bottles of wine to be produced within the boundaries of the new park, and Ridgeview is expected to produce 300,000 bottles in 2010. But Mike's vision is for a South Downs Appellation Control A region to put the area on the worldwide map. Planners say there'll be little change to planning policy, as the South Downs is already protected as an area of outstanding beauty within Sussex. The park would be the ninth national park in England.
Hopefully this will mean our English producers will still be able to continue growing their businesses. One business that's taking a new direction is the wine show. What's going on there, Jane?
The wine show has been purchased by Haymarket Exhibitions, owners of MasterChef Live, which was previously the BBC Good Food Show. And from next year, it will run alongside the food show as a joint event taking place at London's Olympia in November 2010. The wine show has been running for 5 years at the Business Design Centre in Islington, London, and will remain as a dedicated event, but visitors will only have to buy one ticket to gain access to both shows.
Well, it's a shame to see that the wine show is changing and being integrated with food. I quite like the wine event all by itself, but hopefully it'll be bigger and better next year. What's the last story, Jane?
Well, we all know that red wine with red meat and white wine with fish is a good rule of thumb for pairing wine with food. But now researchers in Japan have come up with a scientific explanation as to why this might be. They found that iron in red wine causes an unpleasant fishy aftertaste when consumed with fish. The scientists asked wine tasters to sample 38 red wines and 26 white wines while eating scallops. Some of the wines contained small amounts of iron, but the wines with high amounts resulted in a more intense fishy aftertaste. This fishy taste diminished when a substance that binds the iron together was added to high iron wines, suggesting that low iron reds might be a good match with seafood, and supporting the view that there are exceptions to the white wine with fish rule. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to check out our website 3050.co.uk for these stories in full.
Cheers, Jane. While unusual or unpleasant aromas can be created by combining different chemicals, I still believe that the key reason for whites going with fish isn't so much that they have iron or not iron with them, but it's the weight of the wine. Often white wines are lighter and therefore go with a lighter weight of fish. Also, often fish meals have quite a bit of salt to them, they're quite salty, and salt doesn't go particularly well with tannins. So I think that's probably the two main reasons for it, with red wines having the tannins and white wines not normally. If you're looking for a light red wine that goes with fish, then a great place to look is the World Atlas of Wine, or any old wine atlas to be honest. The usual problems with these wine atlases are that they are huge doorstoppers of a book, which is one of the reasons why the Concise Wine Atlas was created. It's this week's book review. I also have a copy of the book to be given away, which I will give away at the end of the review, so do stay tuned. The Concise World Atlas of Wine by Hugh Johnson and Jancis Robinson isn't actually a new book. Well, certainly not new text anyway. The book is based on the World Atlas of Wine by Hugh Johnson and Jancis Robinson as well. And the text is almost identical. So what's new? Well, it's not so much what's new that's important, it's what's missing which is the key difference. Notably, bulk. The Concise World Atlas of Wine is only 40% of its bigger brother. Gone is its hardback, and in place a smaller, lighter and more flexible book. I say flexible both in terms of the soft cover being able to fit and shape into your backpack more easily, and flexible because it will fit into your backpack and you can take it with you, so it becomes a lot more useful to people. Particularly if you're travelling around, the World Atlas of Wine can only really be practically done by car. I've travelled with the book through France, Italy, and even on planes to Australia, but I've always lugged it with some regret. The concise version is traveller-friendly, whether it's on trains, planes, or automobiles. This is probably its biggest selling point and the key differentiator to its bigger brother, but how have they cut down the size of the book? Well, it's firstly done by using a slightly smaller text size, which is barely noticeable and the text still reads pretty well. And the other area is to cut content. The three main areas that have lost is the foreword, which has been significantly reduced, almost completely stripped out except for the mention of the grape varieties. And also gone are photos. These are photos of the vineyards, the people, and they help give a feel for the place, but not essential. But more importantly, the pictures of labels that the authors have been recommending to give you an idea of typicity have gone as well. Thankfully, the maps, which every wine enthusiast should have a copy of, have been kept. In the end, this book has lost a little content, but gained a lot of portability. And I heartily recommend it to any student or wine nut who wants to travel and wants a detailed set of maps and region explanations with them, such as myself. In the end, I gave the Concise World Atlas of Wine 94 out of 100, which is a cracking score, only really beaten by its bigger brother. I have a copy of it to give away, and thankfully this time it can be shipped anywhere around the world because it's lighter and more portable, i.e. the book review. So if you'd like to get into the draw for it, please give me an email at chris.scott@3050, that's chrityfifty3050.co.uk. Or you can go to our website, 3050.co.uk, and contact us. Do select UK Wine Show and make sure you give us your address so we know where to mail the book off to. You'll go into the drawer and hopefully you'll pick up a copy of it. If you go through the Contact Us, while you're on our website, do select to get our monthly newsletter, which is going to be coming out in the next day or two. We have a second copy of Hugh Johnson's Wine Atlas to give away in our November newsletter, as well as three pairs of tickets to the Wine Gang's first annual tasting in Vinopolis on the 7th of November. You'll need to receive our monthly newsletter to get access to these, but do sign up. It's a particularly good newsletter. Well, I think so anyway. Last week, we asked for entries for our Hugh Johnson's Wine Companion book, and the winner was Ray O'Connor in London. We'll be sending this off to you in the next few days, subject to postal strikes, obviously. Now, I think I need to explain where the books are coming from. When I review a book, sometimes I buy it, and sometimes I get a publisher to send me a copy. In the case of the books we're giving away, they're mostly coming from the publisher. The English Wine book I gave away about a month ago, I'd actually just bought two copies of them, so I thought, well, I'll give it away through the show. Which gave me the idea of giving other books away. So when a publisher contacts us to see if they want to review the book, then I ask them to give me a couple of copies to give away to you guys. Now, I don't make any money out of giving away the book, so don't worry about that. And I also have a link on our website under the book reviews to the publisher who's willing to sell the book to you guys at 40% off the retail high street price. Again, I'm not making any money from it, so I hope you think the reviews are independent, but I think these books are pretty fantastic, and I think everybody should own a copy of them. So, all right, next up, though, we have our second mystery wine clue. So, as I said earlier, this mystery region or appellation has 13 varieties and makes a meaty, spicy red wine. The region is famous for its white pudding stones, which are found throughout the region, although the soils are quite varied. The idea of the pudding stones is it captures heat and reflects it back into the vineyard at night time. And the last clue, which should help most of you, is the region is named after the ruined Popel summer house. That should help some of you guys if you know the region. Okay, I'll give you the answers after this week's interview, which is coming up next. And this week we're talking with Sir George Fisternich. Now, Sir George, because he has been knighted recently, he's the owner of Villa Maria, and he tells us how he built his business to the point of being New Zealand's largest family-run winery. Let's have a listen to what he has to say. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with George Fisternich, the managing director and owner of Villa Maria. How are you, mate?
Very good. I just arrived a few hours ago from New Zealand, so...
Bit jet-lagged?
No, I drank plenty of water and had a few wines with my meal, and I feel good.
What wines did you drink?
Well, I had Villa Maria Cellar Selection Pinot Noir on the plane.
So that's what you didn't try any of the others?
No, well, actually, I asked for a Pinot Noir, because they just happened to have that one on at the moment, yeah.
Yeah. Excellent. Not that you're promoting your own wines or anything like that, but that's excellent. What I want to talk about a wee bit today is the business of Villa Maria. Mm. You set up the company in what, 1961?
Yes, 1961, just as a one-man operation, yeah.
And where did you plant your grapes originally?
Well, actually going back in 1961, there were no varietals, it was all hybrids. Names like Siebel 5455, Siebel 5437, Barco 1, and Albany Surprise.
Quite catchy sort of names for the consumer.
Yeah, but American hybrids, and most of them are grown in Henderson, Kumeu, and Tikawara, which is about 70 k's south of Auckland.
Auckland being the big main city right on top of New Zealand, really. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it was all planted locally, and that's where your original vineyard was as well?
The original vineyard was in Mangere.
Just near the international airport.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
How did the business go? You were growing hybrids?
Well, basically, I had my parents were Croatian. They made wine for our own use, so we had 1 acre of grapes. And I took a lease of that, and it was a mixture of hybrids. So I started off making a dry red and a dry white, and mainly sherry. The market then, which would surprise a lot of people, was... probably about 90% port and sherry, and table wines were almost non-existent.
Yeah,
most people who drank table wines are probably South African or German or French, and it was a very, very small part of the population. New Zealand was very much a beer-drinking country. And it's hard to imagine that, what's that, nearly 48 years later, we've got such strong wine culture.
Yeah. Okay, so you set up in Henderson. When was your first big expansion?
I set up in Mangere.
Oh, sorry.
Well, pretty much 1961, I started the company, also got married and had three children in 5 years. And so pretty slow, pretty much a one-man band with my wife looking after a retail shop. And I went out selling, and then probably towards the late 60s, I started to employ staff. And then into the early 70s, these sort of new varietals, like Chardonnays, Merlots, Cabernets started to emerge, and the industry started to take a change.
But it was still based around Auckland?
Auckland, no, there was actually a wine industry in Hawke's Bay. And, in the early 70s, people moved into Gisborne.
Yep.
Mainly Corbin's initially, and then Montana. Hawke's Bay was, funnily enough, McWilliams.
Yep.
Which is a sort of half, 50% owned by the Australians.
I was going to say McWilliams isn't big Australian.
And then also Vidal's and the Mission were quite prominent in Hawke's Bay.
Yeah.
But it seemed like Hawke's Bay was hundreds of miles away or thousands of miles away from Auckland. And they are like, you just pop down there on a plane every, probably about once a week or once a fortnight. But I got frustrated with Auckland was probably, I suppose in some ways, wasn't suitable for aromatics like Riesling or Sauvignon Blanc.
Too hot and wet.
Yeah. It was good for Chardonnay and actually good for, Pinot, Gris. Grows quite good Gewurz and we've done extremely well with those three varieties. But the other varieties, actually, you really have to get into the Hawke's Bay or later on into Marlborough for Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir and varietals. So the whole industry virtually changed overnight.
When did you plant up in Hawke's Bay?
I started buying grapes in the early 70s out of Hawke's Bay.
Oh, okay. So initially you just had a process and you had your 1 acre plus whatever you bought.
Yeah. And then I sort of ended up sort of getting to know Vidal Winery quite well, and it had gone through some changes from the old Vidal family. They sold it to an Australian company, Seppelt. It became Seppelt Vidals, and then Seppelt Vidals found it was too difficult running a New Zealand winery from Australia. They sold it to their manager. He had it for a couple of years and found it too difficult, so I brought it in 1976. And it gave me 100 acres of good varietal grapes, some Merlot, Chardonnay and Cabernet, so it gave me a good kick start. Yeah.
Because you've got three big brands. So Vidal was the first one you acquired.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And did you get a good price for that?
Going back then, I probably paid, I just brought the business, and then a little bit later on, I brought the buildings. So,
okay, so you bought the brand.
Yeah.
What about the vines themselves?
They had mainly contract vineyards, so it wasn't a huge outlay, but it seemed like enormous by that time, and there was a bit of competition for it. My bank, the bank I'd been with probably for, I suppose that stage, 16 or 17 years, thought I was crazy, so I had to change banks. Another bank looked on more favourably, so I changed banks, managed to fund it,
Okay, so it was all done through debt, was it?
Yes.
Okay. And then, obviously, so you've got Vidal brand, you've got some grapes. Are the grapes being processed in Hawke's Bay, or are they being brought to Auckland?
No, the Vidal's actually was set up as a totally standalone winery. And it used about half the grapes that are available to it. The brand wasn't quite strong enough to use all of them, so then the other half came up to Auckland for Villa Maria. So it was a double benefit. I got the Vidal's brand going as an individual company, and gave me a supply of grapes for Villa Maria as well.
Okay, so did you still use a lot of contract growers then? Or did
we expanded our contract growers, and we were quite strong in Hawke's Bay in terms of contract growers, and the Vidals gave us a good base in terms of having a winemaker and a viticulturist there and a little bit of an office to expand our operations there.
Okay. I read somewhere that you guys were the first people to employ a professional viticulturalist in New Zealand.
Was
that through the Vidals or was it before the Vidal?
No, it was just about the same time, just shortly after that, we employed a girl by the name of Debbie Reed, who had done a sort of a bachelor agriculture degree, and she looked after our vineyards and quality control.
I suppose when you, what was it, 100 acres you said you had? 100
acres? Yeah, 100 acres then.
That's a fair old amount of grapes, so you don't really want to be out there doing it yourself, do you?
100 acres then is like probably 1,000 hectares now. It seemed incredibly large. Yeah. Now it's quite small, of course, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Okay, so
1976, then you've got a reasonable, you've got two brands going. You've got the Villa Maria brand and the Vital brand. Which was the bigger brand?
Villa Maria was bigger at that stage, yeah. And we also went to Gisborne and started buying grapes out of Gisborne. A lot of people planted Middelfurga initially.
Yeah.
And Chasselas.
Oh, I know, Cookshire.
And actually some Gewurztraminer in Gisborne.
Yeah,
and Millefurgo, also called Riesling Silvana, throughout the mid-70s to probably mid-80s, became 50% of the market. It just became huge.
Mm-hmm.
And different names came up. Montana had a Berncastle, a Riesling. Corbin's came out with a Liebstraum. We came out with a Chasselmino, and lots of sort of Germanic-starting names, and the public actually loved this fruity sort of table wine. And then it lasted about 10 years. And then as the other varietals came on, you know, Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, it collapsed as fast as it grew. So, we actually ended up getting quite big in that area. It was quite competitive.
Yeah. How much competition was there? You've listed a couple of the brands. Some of them don't exist anymore. But Montana's still around. How much competition was there sort of in the late 70s?
The industry was emerging as a new industry. There was a public wine company started up called Cook's Wine Company.
Yeah.
They got absorbed by Corbin's.
Yeah.
Then Briley's, which was a large finance company,
mm-hmm.
and Rothmans, which was a large cigarette company. They got involved in the industry, and they ended up sort of absorbing McWilliams and Corbin's and Cook's.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also Penfolds, who were based in Auckland, which again was a subsidiary under license of an Australian company. And then somewhere over, it was all very competitive, but then what's happened since then, they've all disappeared into Pernod Ricard. Pernod Ricard virtually owns Montana, Corbin's, Cook's, McWilliams and Penfolds have all been absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
And they've only really kept the
Montana brand
to any great extent. And a bit of Corbin's
only in New Zealand, the Corbin's, I think, has been absorbed into the Montana.
Yeah, and then Nobilo's have been absorbed, Kim Crawford more recently absorbed into Constellation.
Mm-hmm.
So we're the only actual private family company left of any size in New Zealand. And I suppose the other company is Dalligut's, which owns Oyster Bay, which is a public company, or semi-public, Dalligut family, but still basically probably, I'd imagine, close to 100% New Zealand owned. All the rest have disappeared.
Lots of small family-owned businesses, though.
So over 600, yeah.
Yeah. Lots of small ones, not really many big ones.
No.
Okay, so we're sort of in the late 70s. Obviously, Marlborough came into view in the 80s, but also I remember there was a big financial crisis in 1982, if I recall.
That's right. There was a surplus of grapes.
And there was a big vine pool.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Is that when the Millefurga became unpopular?
Yes, there was Millefurga and there was Palomino and Chasselas became very unpopular.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was about 83, 84. And it was actually, that was followed by a massive price war, and which was basically started in 84, 85. And wine was sold at virtually half price.
Yeah.
It was very much driven by Briley's, which is a large finance company that had sort of brought out Cook's and McWilliams. And I think they wanted to rationalize the industry. They felt there was only really room for two wineries, not, you know, there was about seven or eight, you might say, what would sit the large wineries in.
Yeah.
And they sort of felt they should be rationalized, and price war would put pressure on, put them out of business. And
how did you survive that time?
Well, I didn't actually initially end the receivership because we lost about $4 million and lost almost all our equity in about 9 months.
Yep.
And then I was followed about 2-3 weeks later by Delegates, which owns Oyster Bay. They went into receivership. and then after Delegates, Nobilo's came very close to receivership. In fact, Nick Nobilo had asked me what was it like, because he'd lost all his money too. they made a last-minute deal to sell off all their land and vineyards,
yep.
Which was unfortunate because they had some good vineyards. So it did actually sort of effectively get rid of three wineries. And then a little bit later on, Glenvale, which was quite a large fortified winery, collapsed, and that's ended up, funny enough, I just recovered from the receivership. I ended up buying it.
How did you get out of receivership? Because if you've lost your equity, it must be quite hard as a business to get going again.
Well, probably because I was the first one to go, it became very public news, and it coincided with Phil and Maria winning three trophies in Australia, and so when the TV and the newspaper came out, by Ian Clark, who was our export manager, just arrived back clutching three big trophies. So that made the front page of a newspaper, trophy-winning winemaker bulldozed out of business. And then the press actually picked up on it. Plus, funny enough, the Prime Minister, leader of the opposition, and it became a little bit of a cry for the unfairness of this big, bad corporate sort of bulldozing the small trophy-winning winery out of business. So.
Yeah.
We got huge public support, and our sales actually increased by about 30%. And then we had our grape growers took a full-page ad. They funded themselves, saying they wanted to keep supplying us with grapes. And the staff did the same, unknown to me. So then one of the financial writers of the National Business Review, a chap by the name Warren Berryman, he actually came out with a two-page article detailing the ruthlessness of the way the corporates sort of dealt with us. So in the end, I managed to attract another partner and then buy half the company back, and eventually I brought the whole company back. Back to a family-owned company. So, and then about 18 months, the Glenvale boys, the third-generation company, they'd been suffering with the aftermaths of the price, well, they lasted a bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to sell to any of the corporates, so they said to me, well, you've recovered. How about you take over our business, which seemed a bit unusual, but in the end, the bank and my partner decided it was a bit of critical mass, some more grapes. And, so it was a rather unusual turn of events, actually.
Okay.
And it's a lovely little winery, Esk Valley, and
it's
going very well.
Oh, excellent. So you took Esk Valley on just at the end of the 80s recession.
Mm.
A lot of grapes were obviously pulled up out of the ground during that. Because I remember, wasn't Helen Clark, who was in charge then?
David Longy.
David Longy, and you were getting paid to pull up grapes.
That's right, yeah.
Did you pull up many grapes?
Not many. Most of the surplus.
Most of the contract growers,
yeah, weren't they? Yeah. Most of the surplus ended up being, it was really part of the corporates. But in some ways it did, because they had, a lot of them planted heaps of grapes to, sort of have, battle for market share.
Yeah.
And they found it was a lot harder to suddenly get market share in the wine industry because, at that stage it was quite a bit of brand loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
So in the end, a fair bit of the $10 million went to the large corporates. Most of the surplus was actually, it was more in the hands of the Cook's Wine Company, which was taken over by the corporates. So.
That's the way it is, though, isn't it?
Yeah,
people always overinvest in vineyards, and then
and
they have to get, because they think, I need more grapes to get market share.
Yeah, but it was funny. In the end, actually, it did do some good because a lot of the grapes weren't suitable, so it did actually create a situation where everybody got rid of anything that was in the wrong place or the wrong variety or had virus. So it did actually improve the quality of the New Zealand wine industry a little bit by accident, but.
Yeah.
So it was beneficial in the end.
And then Marlborough came on stream shortly after that.
Yeah, Marlborough, I think Montana's just had their 30th anniversary,
right,
so it must have been 79. And then Sauvignon Blancs just basically took off, and it's probably over 60% of all our exports now.
Yep, Sauvignon Blanc.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and how quickly before you got into Marlborough?
We went in probably towards the end of the 70s, yeah. And then we initially using contract winemaking facilities down there, and then we built our own winery in 1989, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And did you buy grapes, or was it own your own vineyards?
Initially we brought grapes, and then 92 we actually set up the first unlisted public company. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the funding, being a private company, buy our own vineyards, and of course we wanted to get a good supply of Sauvignon Blanc because it was obviously going to be a very popular variety. So came up with the idea of doing what we call unlisted public company, and we attracted it was $2 million to set up 100 acres of grapes.
Yeah.
And we came up with the idea of 400 shareholders, $5,000 each, mainly attracted to wine lovers, and took us about a year to sell the concept, but eventually took off and gave us 100 acres in Marlborough. And then in 1998, we set another one up called Terra Vitae, which was 400 acres. Mm-hmm. And that sold out in 6 weeks, actually. It got oversubscribed because we'd run the first one. It worked quite well. People got used to the idea. So the second one took off like a rocket, so that was great.
How much? What sort of return would people do people get from these? You know, now
we sold it to more to wine lovers on the basis that half your return we'd give them a big discount on their wine. So providing they if they brought a Terra Vitae, it was at 9,500 shares. So if they spent $2,000 or $3,000 on wine a year, which in the course of a year isn't that much, and yeah, these people were reasonably well off. They'd get about a 25% to 30% discount on their wine. So that combined with a bit of dividend would give them about 9 or 10% in total. It's not huge, but on the other hand, a lot of shareholders, we have barbecues and wine tastings, and we send them quarterly information on how the grapes are grown. They get to meet the managers, and so they're part of a family. Mm-hmm. And we do single vineyard wines off of vineyards, all good vineyards. So so most of the investors actually are in it for the wine tastings, the enjoyment, as well as the fact they do get a return. And the shares have increased in value.
So was,
we've actually merged Terra Vitae and merged Sed into one big company.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process, they divided the shares up into smaller units. But I think overall they've probably gone up about 2.5 times from the inception, yeah.
All right, and the investors are pretty happy.
Oh, yes, yeah, I think, yeah.
And it's quite good for you as well, because not only do you get your capital raised, you get a good supply of grapes, you've also got a market for those grapes afterwards.
That's right, yeah.
I've seen people in Otago trying to set up a similar type of thing, often with houses on the vineyard as all this sort of stuff. I notice you're not in Otago at all, from what I can work out.
No.
Why are you not there?
It's a long, our winery's in Marlborough, it's quite a long way to bring grapes up from Otago.
Mm-hmm.
It does seem to suit boutique wineries more, although we do get some wine made under the Thornbury label out of Otago.
Yeah.
And we have occasionally purchase some Otago Pinot Noir, but we find we're getting really good results out of Marlborough.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Marlborough's actually making really great Pinot Noirs. It just started a little bit later. It's been a little bit branded with the Sauvignon Blanc image, but, I mean, you've got just about every soil type and Marlborough, and I mean, you can go up the Awatere Valley, and you can get higher up in altitude, and you can almost imitate the Otago-like conditions. You can also get very close to the Martinborough sort of conditions, so it's a very versatile area. There's a lot of clay vineyards, there's a lot on the river gravels, there's a lot of flexibility in Marlborough, and I think it's starting to get recognised as making some very great Pinot Noirs here.
Yeah, the Pinots are good, and they're normally quite a bit cheaper than Otago Pinots.
Although Otago's coming down now. So.
Yeah. How are you guys dealing with the...
Like, New Zealand is in a slightly oversupply situation at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Have you cut yields or decreased yields? How have you managed your supply situation?
Well, the industry's... the New Zealand wine industry's got a single body that is comprised of all the... grape growers as well as the winemakers, which is fantastic, actually, getting the two groups combined. It doesn't happen in many countries in the world. They're like two opposite sides of a fence. And so when the surplus happened, there was varying meetings held down Marlborough, where most of the problems arose from, by the wine growers' bodies. And the level of cooperation in terms of controlling the crops and trying to get industry into balance has been quite fantastic. So last year, for instance, the 2009 vintage, there was probably 100,000 tons of grapes was just cut off and put on the ground.
Early on or late in the season?
Early on. So we don't repeat the 2008, and it'll take another year or two to get perfectly in balance, but industry really wants to do it for two reasons. It'll improve our quality substantially, and the 09 vintage wines are fantastic, and also just gets things back into balance, because New Zealand's a fairly high-cost country. You know, our land's expensive. We're a long way away from our markets. We have fairly low crops, so we've got to sort of maintain reasonable price level.
And I've seen some pretty cheap New Zealand sevies.
That's all being sold below cost, and that's unsustainable in the long run. Yeah. And there have been a lot of companies that are losing money, and there's been a few bankruptcies of companies that are, you know, good wine, but no brand. Yeah. They haven't been able to survive the pressure.
What's your key markets now for exporting?
The UK is our biggest market, followed by United States, then Australia, and then Canada.
Okay, so you're into the
United States. But Australia's actually, in terms of general industry, Australia's now bigger than the UK.
For the New Zealand industry?
For New Zealand industry, yeah.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite amazing, yeah.
It's quite handy because you don't have to ship the wine so far.
Makes a turn. I remember when I was growing up in New Zealand and we'd look at the wine shelves and there'd be like a few Savvies from New Zealand and then there'd be just walls of Aussie Reds.
Yeah. I think it's changed.
Yeah. Australians actually fall in love with New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc and Pinot Noir.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
All right then, George, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with George. I remember my dad, who was in the drinks industry at the time, and he was very bitter and twisted over what the Brierleys had done to the New Zealand drinks industry. But by winning awards and having a dedicated staff and an enthusiastic customer base, George managed to leave the recession in the 1980s bigger and better than he went in. Certainly an important message for anybody in this part of the economic cycle, I think. I hope you do like this types of interviews. I really enjoy finding out about businesses such as Villa Maria, how they've done, how they've built their business, and what sort of luck and opportunities they've taken. Next week, we're going to be staying with Villa Maria, and I'm going to be talking with the head winemaker, Alistair Mayling. We talked to him about their strategy of wine awards and about their current wines. Righto, let's have a crack at the mystery of wine region / Appellation. How did you guys get on? I think the ruined Popal Summer House probably should have given it away for some of you guys, or the Pudding Stones. But it was, of course, the Châteauneuf de Pape Appellation Contrôlée. Châteauneuf de Pape has up to 13 grape varieties which are authorised to be used in the Appellation. And they're used for making powerfully and richly coloured red wines, that is Châteauneuf de Pape. Not all the grapes are red, however, but potentially the blend can consist of Grenache, Mourvèdre, Syrah, Sensault, and Roussanne. Grenache is Châteauneuf's most important grape variety, however, and it appreciates the sun and gives rounded, good coloured wines, rich in alcohol, and the important red fleshy aromas. Combined with the other grapes, it makes a meaty, spicy red wine. The region itself is famous for its white rounded pudding stones, which are not found throughout the region, and the soils are more varied than most people think. The region is also named after a ruined Popal summer house. Okay, that pretty much finishes the show. One last thing before we go is the quote. And this time it's from a cartoonist, James Thurber. In one of his cartoons skewing the excess of wine descriptions long ago, he featured a sophisticated saying about a Burgundy. It's a naive domestic Burgundy without any breeding, but I think you'll be amused by its presumption. What a load of hogwash. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.